Hello and welcome to another episode of Casting Views, the podcast that takes a topic each week and, as the name suggests, cast views. At this point in the show, I normally introduce the guest I have on, but this week it's just me. So I thought I'd take this opportunity to delve into a subject that I've touched on briefly a couple of times in previous episodes, but it's always fascinated me for years, and I've seen it make a bit of a resurgence on social media recently, especially on TikTok. And that subject is the Mandela effect, so ultimately false memories. Now, as I said, it's something that just the science and theory behind it fascinates me. So what I want to do is I won't go into too many of the examples, because the aim of this podcast, or the aim of this episode, is more to get under the lid of the Mandela effect, understand possibly reasons why it's a thing and what can contribute to these examples that we're seeing. So before I get into the detail, let's hear from some friends of mine. Now, these two are people I'm so happy that I can call friends, not just of the show, but of mine. And they are Justin and Antonio from Back to the Balcony. So let's hear from them now.
Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert, two titans of cinematic review. Sometimes right, sometimes wrong, but always captivating. Your hosts Antonio of the Cult Worthy Cinema Podcast and Justin Henson of The Movie Wire are here to take you back to the balcony. I really don't do reviews, but for me, it's more about like, hey, everyone, these films exist.
When we go into Siskel and Ebert, we're not always going to agree with Siskel and Ebert, but, you know, there's some aspects we may.
And I think with each episode we're going to do, we're going to understand these guys a lot more than we think we have in all the decades that we've been reading their stuff. The Balcony debuts Tuesday, January 2nd on YouTube and your favorite podcasting platform. Join us.
Right, I am back. So, on to the Mandela effect. So, what is it? The Mandela effect, ultimately, as stated just before the break, is a recollection of false memories, but more so than that, it's the mass recollection. So, it's many, many people who remember something that either did not happen or at least remember it happening in a different way. So why is it called the Mandela Effect? It was named by a writer and researcher by the name of Fiona Broom. She was creating a website of her memories of the former South African president Nelson Mandela dying in prison in the 1980s. The unusual thing about this was, well, one, he didn't die in prison, and two, he didn't even die in the 1980s. In fact, he died in 2013. However, Fiona honestly thought she remembered news coverage of his death. To make things even more confusing, she then had a look, and a number of other people thought the same as she did. Fiona reported that perhaps thousands of other people had written online about having the same memory of Mandela's death since 2010, and she speculated that this phenomenon could be evidence of parallel realities. Now, parallel realities and alternate universes will be something I talk about later on, and it's a fascinating subject in itself. But let's start with a few examples just to give a flavour of what the Mandela effect is when we're talking about it. So a couple of the famous ones are Mr. Monopoly. A lot of people remember him having had a monocle, but it's said that he never has had done. And if you look at Mr. Monopoly on a Monopoly game, he doesn't have one. Now, I believe there might be a single version, there might have been a junior version I remember reading where he may have had one. And this will also feature into some of the reasoning behind things later. Star Wars, Darth Vader telling Luke Skywalker, "Luke, I am your father," in that famous scene in The Empire Strikes Back. But he actually says, "No, I am your father," although in a much more dramatic way than I did. There's an extremely famous one of the Fruit of the Loom logo, the clothing brand, featuring a cornucopia. Or did it? Has it ever done? People are arguing that still to this day, and that's the one I've seen make a comeback. To an interesting one I found in a research for another episode. This one comes from Bologna in Italy, and in August of 1980, there was a devastating bomb attack at the Central Railway Station. This damaged the clock that was on display there. Now, in a study, 92% of respondents remembered the clock having stopped because of that bombing and never being restarted, never working again. In fact, the clock was repaired shortly after the attack happened. Years later, however, the clock was again stopped and set to the time of the explosion in observance and commemoration of the bombing. Another intriguing example is the existence of a 1990s movie titled Shazam, starring Sinbad as a genie. Now, Snopes suggests this could be a confabulation, and confabulation is something I'll come on to later as well, of real memories, possibly of Sinbad wearing a genie-like costume during a TV marathon of Sinbad the Sailor movies in 94. The 96 film Kazam, featuring a genie played by Shaquille O'Neal, and the 1960s animated genie theme series Shazam. So there we see three similar-minded programs, films, that potentially could be merged into one that didn't ever exist. And on the Nelson Mandela example, people are saying this could be due to another prominent South African activist called Steve Biko, who died in prison in 1977. So those are some examples. And as I said, look online, you'll find hundreds, if not thousands, and each one in their own right fascinating. But as mentioned, I want to get to the theories as why. So ultimately, the Mandela effect is all about memories. And memories, as we know, can be easily changed or manipulated, whether intentionally or genuinely. So not always saying that a manipulation or the changing of a memory is done maliciously, but there could be many factors as to why something could happen, why a memory could be changed. So I want to start off with something that a guy called Neil Dagnall said. Now, Neil is a cognitive and parapsychological researcher at Manchester University, and he was quoted as saying, "Very often when we're processing information, we see things as we think they are rather than they actually are. Attention is a very interesting phenomenon. With the Mandela effect, people are often remembering things the way they think they should be rather than they actually are, because we just process things very quickly in everyday life." Now, this is a really important thing to bear in mind through the episode. We as people, we're surrounded by hundreds of stimuli every day. When we're out, there are cars, vehicles, bikes, pedestrians, TV screens. We're listening to a podcast, hopefully casting views. There's all sorts of wildlife. You know, everything out there is determined to grab our attention. So if we do witness something, we're seeing it potentially for a split second, and we're not focusing solely on that. So yeah, that's something to have in the back of your mind as we go through this episode. So on to some of the theories. The first one is called fuzzy trace theory. Now, the fuzzy trace theory is a psychological one that focuses on memory and decision-making processes, particularly the context and the way people retrieve their memories. It was coined by Charles Brainerd and Valerie Rayner in the 1990s. The theory states that people encode and store information at two levels: the verbatim, which is precise and detailed information. This is also the storing of surface features of an experience, whereas gist tracing, general underlying meaning, is the way we store the context and interpretation of an event. The fuzzy trace theory relates to false memory in that studies have found that when information is stored as a gist representation, it is more likely to be manipulated or distorted. So again, the terminology there, general underlying, the way we store the context and interpretation of events. So if we've got that slightly wrong, it's going to cloud the rest of the memory itself. This then led me on to something called the construction hypothesis. Now, this also has links or some relation to some of the theories that are going to follow also. The construction hypothesis says that if a true piece of information being provided to someone can alter their answer, then equally so can a false piece of information. The major implications this theory has is that if we're asking somebody a question with a statement that we're believing to be true, that respondent is likely to recall a memory in line with that statement. So if we are saying something that is potentially false, or the person asking the question, it may be their truth, the person being asked will have a tendency to recall their own memory in line with that. So again, a fascinating way at which we can be subtly manipulated again, not maliciously, to think things were different. So now the next couple of theories come from the same person. Now, this is someone called Elizabeth Loftus. She is one of the most famous psychologists who has studied false memories. So she firstly developed the skeleton theory. And this theory explains the process in which we both acquire and recall memories. There are multiple parts to each of these, and these parts can show how we can have memories changed with false information, bias, or misattribution. So let's start with the acquisition, or what we would say the creation of a memory. So the first part of acquiring a memory is we focus on a memory that we eventually have to store. As stated earlier, there is so many stimuli around us that we have to find something specific to focus on. And that element is going to be limited compared to everything else that's going on around it. So this forces you as the observer or the person seeing something to focus or to select a focal point for that memory. Second, our visual perception has to be translated into statements and descriptions. The statements represent a collection of concepts and objects, and they are the link between the event and the recall. So the statement could be as simple as saying, "There is a coffee cup on the table." The last part of this process is something that maybe we're not aware we are doing. So it involves making meanings of our statements from past information or perceptions. So if we take the statement previously, "There is a coffee cup on the table," this final step could turn that into, "Joe's coffee cup is on the table," or "There is a delicious cup of coffee on the table," or "The coffee cup on the table shouldn't be there." So as we start adding statements and meanings to memories, this is where things can change. Now, the second part of the skeleton theory explains what happens when we have to retrieve a memory. So a person recalls a memory based on the stimuli that we focused on. So there may have been a coffee cup on the table, but we didn't notice there were some biscuits next to the cup or someone saying, "Don't touch that coffee." So with this observation, they bring all the memories and perceptions that you've collected before and after. And the second part of recalling the memory is communicating the memory to others. So you are ultimately expressing a picture of the scene with all the input, again, that you collected from the initial input. So the result of all this is the recalling of a memory that's either going to be accurate or inaccurate. Now, the second big investigation that Elizabeth Loftus did was one I've mentioned in the psychological experiments episode. And if you haven't listened to that, I honestly do recommend that. I mean, I would say that, but it's one of my most favourite ones because of the subject matter. So this was a study she did along with John Palmer in 1974 to investigate the effects of language on the development of false memories, and it involved two separate studies. Firstly, 45 people were randomly assigned to watch different videos of a car accident, in which each video had shown collisions of a car going at either 20 miles per hour, 30 miles per hour, and 40 miles per hour. They were then asked a question about it. Now, the question was about how fast were the cars going when they blank each other. Now, the blank there is extremely important, because what then happened were some people were given the word smashed, some people were given the word collided, some people were given the word bumped, some hit, some contacted. So imagine being given the statement. You see, you've watched a video of a car accident, and then you're asked about how fast were the cars going when they bumped each other, as opposed to about how fast were the cars going when they smashed each other. So following this, participants estimated collisions of all speeds to average between 35 miles per hour to just below 40 miles per hour. And if we look at the table itself, those who answered the question with the word smashed took the average speed estimate to be 40.8 miles per hour. Collided was 39.3, bumped 38.1, hit 34, down to contacted, which was as low as 31.8. So as stated in this article, depending on speed limit and other factors, if this was a criminal case, 8 miles per hour could make or break a case. So the power of suggestion can have a powerful impact on a memory. And imagine if this memory was being used in a court case. So it's fundamentally how important this is to show how we can have memories change. And these were people watching a video there and then. This isn't recalling something from 6 months ago, let alone a year ago. The second part of this experiment showed participants a video of a car accident with follow-up questions. Now, 150 participants were randomly assigned to three conditions for this test. Those in the first condition were asked the same question as the first study using the verb smashed. The second group asked a question with the word hit, and the final group was not asked about the speed of the crashing cars. However, the interesting part of this study was that the participants were then also asked to see if they had seen any broken glass in the video. Now, there was no broken glass. There was absolutely no broken glass in the video. But the responses given to the question depended on the verb that was used. Now, a larger sum of participants in the smashed group declared there was broken glass. So, again, how suggestive wording is to a person and their memory. Ultimately, what Elizabeth Loftus' study has proved is that the words used to phrase a question can heavily influence the response given, and that the phrasing of a question can give expectations to previously ignored details and therefore a misconstruction of our memory recall. So all of this, you can now start seeing how false memories could potentially be made. But there can also be natural reasons for why people gain false memories, right? I mean, one of the amazing things about humans is we are all different. Creativity, our characters, our personality. So it's also been found in studies that a greater creative imagination can relate to more false memory formation. But also, quite importantly, individuals who feel under pressure may be more likely to reluctantly accept false details given to them. So perceived pressure from an authority figure may lower an individual's acceptance or resistance to accepting false information as true. But also hugely important, sleep deprivation. But researchers have actually discovered a simple method of inducing false memories. Now, this is called the Dees-Roediger-McDermott task paradigm. I'm going to just refer to it as DRM now, just to keep it simple. So during the DRM task, participants are given a list of words that are related, such as zebra, whale, snake, elephant. After reading that list, researchers will then ask the participants whether or not they recall a word that's related but was not in the list. They call this the lure word. Participants often will recognise this word and recall having read it, even though it was never on the list. Now, this, to me, this is really fascinating, because this isn't recalling an event that happened around 10 other things going on in the world. This is a list of words on paper given to you, and you're then asked if another word was in there and you're remembering it to be there just because it's related to it. And again, I find stuff like this fascinating, because we like to think we know exactly what we've seen. Our memories are exact. But this DRM test proves that we can be easily susceptible to misremembering. So where does the sleep deprivation part come of this? So what they did, they took this DRM test and then took two groups. One group were given a list and were then allowed a good night's sleep. The other group had a night of sleep deprivation. Testing took place the next day, and the study showed, or at least one study showed, higher rates of the false recognition in the sleep deprived participants compared to those who were well rested. So again, we're not just contending with our own memories, our own minds, our own personalities. We're not just contending with everything that's going on around us. And again, think of your commute to work or a walk down a busy high street. We're also contending with how we're feeling that day. Have we had a good night's sleep? Are we feeling ill? All these things are mixing to potentially give us false memories of an event. So this leads us on to confabulation, which was mentioned earlier in the article from Snopes around the film called Shazam. So confabulation is where a person, when put on the spot, will create false memories to compensate for holes in a memory, in a recollection of something. Now, This isn't to say they're lying or are doing it to mislead someone else, but we often, if put on the spot, we'll try to fill in the gaps, or we may falsely link something to something else. So also with confabulation, this can be linked to a memory disorder. So again, another theory that can explain why people are coming up with differences in memories from other people, because it's just the way they're trying to piece together two elements of a memory with a piece that's missing. There is another term in psychology called priming. Now, priming is where exposure to a stimulus directly influences a person's response to a subsequent one. So, for example, if a person was to read or hear the word grass, they're going to recognise another related word, such as tree or lawnmower, far more quickly than an unrelated word. Priming also uses suggestive techniques to trigger a certain response. So, for instance, did you grab the red ball from the shelf is much more suggestive than the phrase, did you take anything from the shelf? Because the second phrase is far more general and open-ended, while the first describes the action of a specified object, the red ball. So the first phrase has a stronger influence on a memory than the second. So now we kind of get onto the interesting bit that I said earlier. So Fiona Broom, in her investigation, posited the potential for alternate realities or parallel universe. Now, as mentioned, Fiona describes the Mandela effect as a clear memory of an event that never occurred in this reality. So her explanation ties into many theories out there that the Mandela effect occurs when our reality interacts with other alternate realities or parallel universe. However, there is no scientific support to back these up, although scientists do claim for the possibility of multiple universes by string theory. So whilst talking about the possibility of parallel or alternate universes, it brings me back to another reason or another theory I'd found floating around on the internet as to why we have false memories or why Mandela effects are so prevalent. Now, what was interesting, I found this for a conspiracy theory episode I did, and I tried to find the thread and the information on this that I had the first time round, and I actually wasn't able to. So is that the Mandela effect? Have I proven it in investigation for this? Because I can't find something I definitely did previously, or is my Googling skills just not up to par these days? But what this thread suggested was that the world as we knew it ended in 2012. The root of this theory extends to the Large Hadron Collider. So the Hadron Collider is the world's largest and highest energy particle collider. It's built in Switzerland, and it was built by the European Organisation for Nuclear Research, CERN. Now, what this is, if I remember right, and obviously in a really non-scientific way, but it was almost like an absolutely massive oval where particles are just flung around it at high speed in an attempt to find, at the time, it was the Higgs boson particle. Now, again, not being scientific, but the Higgs boson particle was massively important to find because this is what was responsible for giving other particles their mass. So in the science world, this was absolutely huge. Coming back on topic to the Mandela effect, what people are suggesting is that this collider, this event, created a massive black hole that ultimately ingested the world, and the scientists have put us all in a simulation. So the world we knew has been replaced by a new simulation, and we've not got certain elements of the details right, hence why we've got all these misrecalled memories. But, you know, could it be just as simple as we are being confused by different versions of things? So a really famous example of a Mandela effect is the Queen song, We Are the Champions. So when people sing it or singing along, they'll finish it with the words of the world, and I'm not going to sing it for you, so you'll probably be pleased about that. But if you have sung that at the end of the song, you'll notice that it's not correct. And they just finish with the words, "We are the champion." Now, what could cause this? Now, there are versions of the song where they finish with that. Mainly, I think there's a few live concerts. It may even have been Live Aid, but there's a few live versions of the song where they finish with that. If I remember correctly, I think one of the choruses actually does have that in there. It's just the final one doesn't, but everyone is convinced that the song finishes with it. So I guess what I'm trying to say is, in this day and age where we've got multiple re-releases, deluxe versions, collector's editions, director's cuts of films and songs, are we just getting confused with different versions? And thanks to social media, we can make these more prevalent. Possibly. So linking into that was really, really interesting. Well, interesting to me that I found scanning through the internet when I was doing... Well, it actually wasn't even related to this research. I just found an article on Stranger Things, and I'm a fan of the show on Netflix, and I found an interview that the Duffers did with Variety magazine on the 24th of June 2022. Now, I think this was when... It's probably just after release of the second season, but I want to read part of the article out as it is, and then I'll come back to how fascinating this could be or what implications it could have for future memories. So I quote from the article: "One revelation from the conversation was that, yes, they're likely going to George Lucas, aka Go Back, also known as going back and altering what's already on screen. The mistake the show made in episode 2 about Will's birthday already having been established as March 22nd. In an interview with Variety in early June, they posited a contingency in which they might go back and change the season 2 episode in which Joyce mentions the date. Matt Duffer told Variety in that interview that they were considering making Will's new birthday May 22nd because May can fit in Winona's mouth in that season 2 episode, so that would be us George Lucasing the situation. As it turns out, it wouldn't be the first time. We have George Lucas things that people don't know about," he continued, while declining to detail specific alterations from previous seasons. Ross Duffer said, "You do have physical copies though, the Blu-rays and stuff, so you'd have to compare." He then let slip that they even changed something from Volume 1 after it had already gone up on May the 27th. "Some of the visual effects," said Ross, "it's not like story, but you're essentially patching in shots. Netflix is... I don't think they've ever allowed people to patch on opening week and even weekend. And we said, well, why not? And they said, well, it makes us nervous. And we're like, well, maybe we try it this time. And it turned out fine." So just in that interview there, we've seen a couple of things. So they've changed what a character has said a season later because, one, they realised it creates a plot hole, but also that they've looked at what the character was saying in that episode and realised that they could change it. Now, the second part of that is going back into an episode and changing potentially some effects. So they've admitted they've not changed anything fundamental to the story. But imagine you've watched it and you've watched the original and I've watched it a week later. When we're talking, we're going to have different views. Or you've watched it. So imagine you've watched it week one. You then come to watch it a year later. You're doing a rewatch of the show before the new season comes out. You're watching it and you're going to think, I don't remember those effects, or I remember that being different. It then goes up onto social media, and then there's going to be not just you, there's going to be hundreds, if not thousands, of other people that have done exactly what you've done. And because this isn't big news, it's not mentioned, they don't, you know, maybe there is a tiny thing that says somewhere this program has been altered since the original version, but who's going to read that? So digital streaming of films, shows, potentially even music are going to be easily susceptible to some of this patching, as they say, or reworking. So are we going to see a future generation of Mandela effects because of this? And closely linked then, my final point, is the internet. So I've said on this show a number of times that the internet obviously is amazing. Social media, especially when used the right way, is an absolutely brilliant platform. However, we do know it's also a great way of spreading misinformation. So in the past, with Photoshop alone, now we've got the onset of deepfake and AI in the hands of people at home. We are living in an age now where we could potentially make anything look old and different, or look different now. So are we also being tricked by people cleverly using AI or deepfaked or photoshopped items to claim that they've got proof of the Mandela effect being real? I mean, when something becomes viral, everyone, you're so quick. We've all done it. We'll press a like, we'll press the repost button, quote it. But that then just keeps getting it out there. And where's the backtrack? You never see a retraction of something. People just love being at the start of something viral or being part of something new and exciting that's potentially been discovered. So, yeah, like I said, this is obviously just a real touching of the subject, a real just surface level skim of something I found fascinating. And I hope you've enjoyed it too. I mean, yeah, go look up the Mandela Effect online. If you've got favourite examples of it, do let me know. I mean, like I said, the theories I've put forward are just something I was interested in to understand why and how we as people can have false memories and what they can be influenced by. So you're listening to me, so you know where to find me for the show. But if you want to get in touch with me on social media, just look for me across all the platforms at Casting Views. My email is castingviewspod@gmail.com. If you want to give me any feedback on here, give me any examples, just want to say hello, or you want to be on the show, that's where you can get me. And yeah, let me know what you think about the Mandela Effect, and I will see you next week.
If I want your opinion, I will give it to you. Come on, check what we've got, 'cause you need it, don't make us get